It's time. Time for stimulating talk. Time for thought-provoking conversation. Time for the Lisa Wexler Show on WICC 600. Turn on your brain and get the real scoop on today's topics and events. Here is Lisa Wexler.
Welcome to the show today. Coming up on the show, we've got Jeff Grant, who will be joining us to talk a little bit about his life, the full circle. He was a very active and successful lawyer. He became an addict. He did some bad things. He went to jail. He got out of jail. He founded a ministry ministering to other incarcerated people or formerly incarcerated people that were trying to climb back up the hill in life. He kicked his own addiction. And then he just got his license back to practice law. And he wants to come on and talk about his journey and the ways in which he's learned and has brought his lessons to the larger community, particularly here in our Greater Bridgeport community. So Jeff Grant will be joining us today. And 203-333-9422 is our number. He'll be coming on at 10:30. And then in the next hour, I have to tell you, I want you to not miss this. So let me back up a little bit. I wasn't here with you on Friday. I had quite a couple of days. 203-333-9422, and I want to tell you all about them. But on Saturday morning, I had the great privilege. I was invited by Frank Recchia of News 12 to meet him there because he wanted to do a little TV thing on the Wednesday segment that we do with Wayne Winston every Wednesday at 11:30 on Race. It's getting a lot of traction in the community, and he wanted more people to know about it. And so it was what we call a stand-up, where Wayne and I stood up and we talked a little bit about it, and they threw it on News 12 over the weekend. I hope you had a chance to see it. And in the meantime, but he invited me to a place to do it, and I thought, you know, it was just a convenient place for him to meet. But it turns out where he invited me to meet was at Hall Community House, which was celebrating its 135th anniversary in the east end of Bridgeport. I'm thinking of Baltimore lately. It's on my brain. Bridgeport. And right in the middle, and it was a gorgeous, glorious day on Saturday, wasn't it? It was just a perfect day. It wasn't humid. It wasn't sunny. There were just enough clouds to enjoy the beautiful weather. And it was a nice gathering in a parking lot of people that were committed to Hall House and the programming that it offers. And they had the bouncy box, and they had some people doing, you know, funky jewelry and fun, you know, playing tattoos and a couple of good food trucks. I had some yummy tacos. But the bottom line was that I got to meet a gentleman named Jonathan Lett and interview him and three lovely girls. They are girls, ages 11, 12, and 13, who are doing the hip hop program on Saturday mornings. And then I went into the gym and watched them practice. And not only watched them practice, but I watched a couple of face-offs between other people doing hip hop. And I have to tell you, I had the most fun, really, that I've had in such a long time. It brought me back to when I was a kid, hanging out in a gym with just the fun and the, I don't know, just the fun and the realness of just hanging out and having a good time. And that's what they were doing, hanging out and having a good time, learning how to do dancing, getting ready for the Juneteenth parade next Saturday at Seaside Park in Bridgeport. And then after that, their own recital in July. So I got to interview some of the girls as well as Jonathan. We're going to put that on at 11:30 this morning. It was so much fun. The day before, the reason I had to miss being with you on Friday was because I went to the Talkers Convention, which is a once-a-year thing, but last year was canceled. This year it was by invitation only, and it was at half capacity. And I was invited to join a panel in the afternoon where, of course, you know me, I had to make some noise. I was told I was spicy. Is anybody surprised? I'm a talk radio host. Anyway, but Bill O'Reilly was one of the featured people during the day. He lives in Garden City. We happen to have had the conference at Hofstra University because they have a very, very well-recognized radio station at Hofstra. And it's an award-winning radio station. They have beautiful studios. I've been to tour them, and they had a really lovely auditorium for us to do our event. Michael Harrison, who publishes Talkers Magazine, is the host of the conference, and he's the person who establishes it. And anyway, he was on the stage with Bill O'Reilly. Remember Bill O'Reilly from Fox News? He had quite a run until he ignominiously was excused because of the disclosure of all of the sexual harassment monies that Roger Ailes and the powers that be at Fox News had paid out on his behalf. He still was getting great ratings, and he was still very much a draw for the audience. But in the time of the Me Too movement, he was asked to step aside. Now, he has since made a killing, you should excuse the expression, with his, quote, Kill series, which he claims has surpassed even the journalist Bob Woodward as having the most amount of New York Times bestsellers ever in New York Times bestseller history by one author. He claims he's had 14 now. And he calls them the Killing series because it's killing Lincoln, killing this one, killing that one. He's got one going right now. I don't remember the name. And anyway, Bill O'Reilly was on to talk about the breaking news that had broken just the day before that he had gotten former President Donald Trump to agree to go on a history tour with Bill O'Reilly that will begin in December of this year, December 2021. I don't know how many stops they'll be making. Bill O'Reilly was talking to the audience about what it took to get Donald Trump. They've been friends for many years. And apparently, former President Mr. Trump is going to be making a lot of money from the tour, as well as he should, because let's face it, he's the draw for the tour. But Mr. O'Reilly promised that he would be pulling no punches and giving his typical, one can be expected, quote, hard-hitting interviews. We'll see. What he wants to do, the purpose of the tour, is to create a record of the Trump administration, which, according to Mr. O'Reilly, doesn't exist in the newspapers because he feels that all the newspapers are terribly biased against President Trump, and therefore there isn't what he wants to consider to be a very good historical record where former President Trump is reflecting on what he accomplished in 4 years of office. So we'll see. But anyway, that's what he was on the stage to do. That was one interesting part of the day. There was a lot to the day, and I really enjoyed it. I was on a panel myself, as I said earlier, in the afternoon, talking about integrity in talk radio, which begs the question, is that an oxymoron? Hopefully not. And then on Saturday, I went to Bridgeport to do that and then did the stand-up. And then in the afternoon, if you follow me on Instagram or you're a friend on Facebook, you're going to see pictures of me and videos of the new puppy. So Bill and I schlepped up to West Granby. It might be East Granby. It's something Granby. Near East Granby, thank you. Near Barkhamsted. It's so gorgeous up there. It's so beautiful up there. And it's only a few miles from the airport in Hartford. It's actually only 7 miles from Southwick, Massachusetts. That's the corner of Connecticut that it's in. And it happens that our breeder lives there on 20 acres and a farm. I mean, it's like, you know, you want to talk about a bucolic place for puppies to be born. And she takes really good care of them. So there were 5 little ones. They were barely 4 weeks old. They were turning 4 weeks the next day. And I'm standing several feet because I don't want to crowd the little pups. And one out of the 5, and she knows I want a male, and one out of the 5, and it happened to be a male, walks and sits on my foot. And I'm wearing an Allbirds shoe. Allbirds is like this wool comfortable shoe, but the grass is comfortable too. This little thing, this little cup of a thing, walks onto my shoe, and I don't have a big foot. I'm 7.5. The puppy fits into my little shoe, into my foot, and sits on my foot and then tries to crawl up my leg a little bit. It was the cutest thing you ever saw. Only one of the 5. And eventually I sit down, and the puppy cuddles with me before he puts himself to sleep and stays with me for 2 hours. For 2 hours. And it was the only one of the 5 that barely showed an interest in me. So we put a little magic marker on the tail, the breeder did, because at this point, nobody knows what puppy is which, and it's way too soon to take a puppy home. Puppies are still feeding on the mommy, which I got to see, Sophia, good mommy. And then in 2 weeks, we'll visit again, and hopefully that same puppy will still take an interest in me. And then we'll pick up the puppy in about 8 or 9 weeks. And that's when the breeder wants us to. That's what she says is the optimal time, because she says the mom around 6 weeks, is starting to scatter the pups, doesn't want them anymore. She's exhausted. She's weaned them. They're already taking a little bit of kibble at 4 weeks. By 6 weeks, she's done with them, and she really doesn't want to see them anymore, according to the breeder. So the breeder feels that at 8 weeks would be an optimal time to pick up the pup. So then we're going to have two Bichons. We're going to have Shayna, and we've tentatively named the next one Yofi, which I love that name. Yofi means happy or wonderful or good job in Hebrew. Yofi, you say something is Yofi, it's good. So I'll have Shayna and Yofi, two little Hebrew little Jewish little doggies. And all will be well. It's a great weekend. So that's my news. That's my catch up with you about what happened in my life over the weekend. And then yesterday, I pretty much just conked out. 203-333-9422 is our number. When we come back, lots of news highlights. I need to tell you what's going on in our legislature. Some of the criticisms that have been leveled at some of the policymaking in secret or in relative secret. And then also what is still up for discussion and implementation. So stick around for news you can use on the Lisa Wexler Show at 203-333-9422.
Streaming online, on your phone, and on your smart speaker. The Lisa Wexler Show is back on WICC 600.
203-333-9422. And my Instagram handle is Lisa Wexler Radio. Apparently, there's more than one Lisa Wexler in the world, so please follow me if this is part of your social media life, because I'm posting little reels. I posted a reel of me with all the puppies. I think you'll enjoy it. 203-333-9422. I want to talk a little bit now about the First Amendment and these First Amendment auditors, which is a new phrase I hadn't heard of before, but apparently it's a thing, and frankly, it seems to me to be a very necessary thing. So what's happening in the world, big picture and big idea, is that we've got this thing called freedom of speech. And with that freedom of speech, a pertinent to it, if you will, in legal parlance, are our rights to be able to photograph, even video, people in public spaces doing public things so that the rest of us can know what's going on. And when people are stopped from doing that, they believe their First Amendment rights are being violated. So, for example, the easiest one to think about is the woman who took the footage of the police officer who was arresting George Floyd, right? It was because of that video that all the rest of us saw what happened to George Floyd. And I think it's safe to say if we hadn't seen the video, no one would have believed what really happened to George Floyd. How would anybody believe that a police officer for 9 minutes would do what he did in cold blood like that? I mean, he was convicted of murder for a reason. Okay. So sometimes what happens is that somebody who tries to videotape something like that gets turned on, and police come to that person and they say, you don't have the right to do that. And that person says, I absolutely have the right. You're doing your duty in broad daylight, and I have my right to photograph it because it isn't just my eyes that have a right to see it in broad daylight. I have the right to share it with others. And this First Amendment auditing is a movement that is spreading throughout the country. Now, the big idea that we need to keep in mind is that we have a First Amendment that is truly under attack in many different ways. We have revelations that the Trump administration, under its Justice Department, under Bill Barr, procured the Apple cell phone texts and messages of Don McGahn and his wife. Don McGahn was a White House counsel in the White House. And I think he believed he had a right to privacy in his Apple cell phone text, but the Justice Department spied on him and got Apple under subpoena to turn over the records. Now, why they did that, why they were gunning for Don McGahn when he was already in the Trump White House and assumedly loyal to President Trump, well, I'll let others speculate on that. We've got a First Amendment under siege. We've got revelations of the Justice Department making sure they had records of prominent journalists at the New York Times and other publications, which means First Amendment to include freedom of the press under siege, under attack by the government itself. And we have countless examples of threatened and defensive police departments that come down on people that want to take photos and videos of them doing their job in real time for the reason that they think that if the public gets a look at it, that that action will be mischaracterized or taken out of context or clipped and edited in such a way as to make the police officer look bad when the police officer was reacting to a set of events that was not filmed and was not videotaped. And so all you end up seeing in terms of the police is the aftermath, is the capture, is the try-in arrest, is the detention. And you very frequently don't see the provocative event that caused it, because the public is alerted when they see the altercation between a police officer and the person, the would-be suspect, but they often don't see why the police officer is going after the suspect to begin with. So you've got both sides of this in the public realm. The story that reached the attention of the rest of us here in Fairfield County is in Danbury, where a YouTuber prompted a Danbury police investigation where the chief of police of Danbury says he's not happy with the footage that he has seen that we haven't seen yet of how his Danbury police reacted to this. Now, this is interestingly enough, it happened in a library. It happened in a library. A YouTuber named Sean Paul Reyes refused to stop recording video in the Danbury Public Library last Wednesday. But there's a library policy that bans film or photography without permission from the library director. And in the video, Mr. Reyes says, "I'm engaging in a First Amendment protected activity. I'm gathering content for a story. I have freedom of the press. This is a public building. I'm allowed to be here. I'm allowed to record, regardless of what their policy says. Policy does not trump law." He's from Long Island, and he has a YouTube channel called Long Island Audit. And he says his goal is to educate other police officers and spread awareness about First Amendment rights. And he's planning to come to Connecticut to make more videos. He told Hearst Connecticut Media, "I'll definitely be exposing any tyranny out here. My intention is not to agonize the police. Antagonize. That's an interesting choice of words. Antagonize the police. My intention is to exercise my rights peacefully and educate the police." And so he was not happy with the way he was treated by Danbury police. He filed an intent to sue with the city, and he wants to sue on account of his civil rights being violated. Now, what's interesting to me is that a library is a very interesting kind of venue. There have been cases that have been held that a library is a place of limited public access. In other words, you're allowed as a human being to go and take any book you want out of the library. But others are not necessarily allowed to film you taking that book out of the library because you have your own First Amendment right to browse and choose and select whatever book you like. And in fact, if you'll recall, when the Patriot Act was first being passed, it was the Librarians of America who objected so strongly because they did not want to have to turn over the records of the books that people took out of the library. They felt that that was a privacy right that people had associated with the First Amendment that should not be violated by means of passing the Patriot Act. And they were right. And that portion of the Patriot Act went away. But of course, we have now, nobody goes to a library anymore. Their library is Google and Wikipedia. And so if you subpoena Apple records or you subpoena Google records, you know exactly what somebody is searching for and what they're interested in learning about. So today that's been hacked. Today that conversation is no longer relevant. But the bottom line is, when you go to a library, do you think that you should be filmed without your consent? This Mr. Reyes thinks when you go to a library, you forego all of your First Amendment rights in terms of your right to be filmed or photographed. And because you're in a public space, somebody else has a right to take a picture of you in that public space and post it on social media. The library director in Danbury says not so fast. Mr. Reyes says that the police mishandled it altogether, that they manhandled him, and he is suing the police for violation of his civil rights in connection with the incident. So it's a fascinating, as a judge, I will step back and tell you, it's a fascinating case because you've got the extent to which people have First Amendment rights by anonymously browsing in a library. You have the extent to which somebody who goes into the library has a camera and may have some rights, but not all rights. Then you have this, the specific nature of the complaint and the fact that the police responded And the way the police responded, which Mr. Reyes says was an overreaction, was assaultative in nature. And you have the Danbury police chief saying that he viewed the footage and he wasn't happy with the way his officers responded to this. And now you've got a lawsuit against the city of Danbury on account of the way the police responded to this. So many different layers and many different colliding compelling interests in America right now. I'm Lisa Wexler. We're going to be right back. We're going to chat with Jeff Grant. He's going to talk a little bit about his journey from being a lawyer without a record, practicing law in this world, to a cycle of addiction and crime, serving time in prison, coming out, finding God and a ministry to help others, and ultimately resulting in his own full circle professional rehabilitation. He'll tell you the details. We'll be right back with Jeff Grant on the Lisa Wexler Show. You can call in with your comments and your questions anytime. Feel free to interrupt 203-333-9422 and be part of the show.
Got something on your mind? Tell Lisa all about it. 203-333-9422. It's the Lisa Wexler Show on WICC 600.
And welcome back to the show. We were just chatting about Danbury and the fact that in Danbury, the police have been viewing footage. They say they're not so happy with the way their own police officers responded, but we haven't seen the footage yet. We may never see it. And Mr. Reyes, who calls himself a First Amendment auditor, went into the Danbury Public Library to shoot footage. And the Danbury Library director said, no, you don't have the right to do that. The police were called, and apparently the way in which that was handled may have resulted in some kind of an altercation, Mr. Reyes says, an overreaction. And he filed suit. He filed a notice of intent to suit against the city of Danbury, all in connection with what he believes is his right to monitor public buildings like town halls and capitals, like our capitol that's been closed in Hartford, and the town halls that now require people to sign in on the assumption of contact tracing, query whether or not they're really doing contact tracing in this time of COVID and whether or not that's a legitimate enough reason at this point to require people to sign into town hall. Let's go to Jim from Stratford. Hey, Jim, welcome.
Good morning. How are you? Happy Monday.
Lisa, thank you.
Listen,
me too.
Before you say anything about this guy Reyes, okay?
Yeah.
I'm going to suggest that you take a look at the 34-minute video that he shot on this Danbury thing.
Okay. That's a long time.
You're going to have to shorten it for me.
I don't have 34 minutes in my day, Jeff, but you tell me.
Okay. Well, you just take a look at it, okay? Because you got to see the composure that those cops had. Okay.
Oh, okay.
And the baiting that this guy Reyes is doing, okay, and it's going to show up again because he's threatening to come to Connecticut again. He is really, really, I don't know what his game is, but I mean, the insults that he threw at these cops was unbelievable. And the composure that those cops had, I got to give them a lot of credit. They did it right by the numbers. But really, I suggest that people look at that video. It's 34 minutes. It's on YouTube. And then you make your judgment about this guy, okay? And all is lost if we continue to keep the attacks the way people are attacking this country.
You know, Jim, listen, in a situation like this, and like so many others, but particularly when you have somebody who has a desire to make news by creating some kind of an altercation or something that they can, you know, have people get eyeballs to the YouTube video. The police are tested enormously in terms of how to handle a situation without making it worse, without looking bad. As I said earlier, by the time we often see what happens with police, we're not seeing the provocation. We're only seeing how the police responded, which is not to excuse excessive brutality, and it's not to excuse escalation, and it's not to excuse overreaction. But I understand what you're saying. But I do want to say this. Chief Patrick Ridenhour said in a Thursday statement that he, quote, has significant concerns with how the officers and sergeant handled the situation. It's because he said that, Jim, that I raised the story.
Yeah, I get it, okay? And I understand the position he's in. But you got to see this video, okay? Take the time this afternoon to see it. Because this guy Reyes is way off base. And I got to give a lot of credit to the Danbury cops and the way they handle this situation. Okay. With that, I'm going to let you go, kiddo. Happy Monday.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim. Let's turn now to Jeff Grant, who knows a little bit from his own personal experience about way the police can make arrests and how they do their thing, because not only was he arrested and served time for his own crime, which he's going to tell us about, but after coming out of jail, he and his wife formed a ministry to minister to other people that were incarcerated, that may still be incarcerated, helping them have hope and focus for a second chance at life. And he's got his own redemption story that he wants to share with us. Jeff Grant, welcome to the Lisa Wexler Show today. Good morning.
Hi, Lisa. It's so good to talk to you again.
It's great to talk to you. Sorry we're not in person this time.
It's been a few years, too. Well, at least I have some new news.
You do. So, Jeff, give us a little bit, you know, the quick story of how you came to be in jail in the first place. How long did you serve? What prison you were in? Talk to us.
I served almost 14 months in Allenwood Low Security Correctional Institution in White Deer, Pennsylvania. And that wasn't a camp. That was a real prison with bars and controlled movements and all. Although I qualified for a camp, that's not where I got designated. I was a lawyer, and I developed a drug habit in the 1990s, prescription opioids. So I was certainly early one of those people who were prescribed by doctors, first Demerol and later some OxyContin. And little by little, my decision-making disintegrated, my ability to show up for my firm, show up for my family. And I wound up commingling client escrow funds, meaning I borrowed client money, used it to make payroll, which was a grievable offense. I, not that long after, came under the scrutiny of the grievance committee in New York, who was doing an investigation. It was pretty obvious that I was going to lose my law license ultimately, but I defended it. And then 9/11 happened, and I took it real hard. I wound they were offering SBA disaster loans like they are offering now, and very little underwriting. They were offering it to anyone who was in a surrounding county who could show economic injury, whose business could show an economic injury as a direct result of 9/11. My business had been affected by 9/11, but honestly, there was no way for me to tell how much was because of my prescription drug habit or how much was 9/11. And I lied on the application. I said I had an office in downtown Manhattan, which I did not. The nuances of that are not that important. The bottom line is I lied, and I knew it because I was desperate and stoned, and I needed, or I thought I needed the money to save my business, but my business was unsavable. And in July of 2002, it became clear that the jig was up. There was no way for me to continue. I resigned my law license, and that night swallowed 40 hits of Demerol and tried to kill myself.
Oh, Jeff. I didn't remember that. I didn't know that.
Mm. Yeah. That was the best. That's like end of my old life.
Who found you? How did you live?
I woke up in the morning in a pool of vomit, crawled to the kitchen to try to find more pills. There was nothing there that was going to be helpful. And a few days later, I checked into Silver Hill Hospital in New Canaan and spent 7 weeks in rehab. Came out and started going to recovery meetings in Greenwich. And I went to an average of about 3 a day. In the meantime, I lost my business, was about to lose my family, lost my reputation, lost my friends, lost everything, really. It was terrible. But from a recovery standpoint, I had nowhere to go but up. So I dove into recovery and really turned my life over to it and accepted that my life was unmanageable and turn my life over to the care of God. And that's how it all started in terms of my new life, my second life. And then when I was about 20 months sober, I got a phone call from two federal agents to tell me that there was a warrant out for my arrest. And they gave me 2 weeks to turn myself in. I hired a lawyer. This was in connection with the misrepresentations I had made on my SBA disaster loan. And I turned myself in down at 500 Pearl Street to the federal marshals. And downtown, it was still post 9/11, so there were checkpoints and machine guns and armed militia. And I felt like the worst criminal in the world. And I was arraigned that day. And then spent the next 2 years, 4 years total, just committing to recovery and staying sober. And in on April 16th, that's Easter Sunday of 2006, I reported to prison.
And it must have been very tempting, Jeff, when this happened to you, to go back into your old life, because to some extent, one could see yourself having some self-pity. Oh, I did all this. I'm being so good. Why is God slapping me with this right now?
I can do that any day, Lisa. You know, if I want to get into self-pity, I have that option any day. And some days I do. But there was no question that there was a path that was opening for me. And the path was through sobriety and doing the next right thing and moving my life forward, because I certainly couldn't go back. My wife had kicked me out. I was basically homeless until I went to prison. Homeless in Greenwich is not such a terrible thing, because homelessness is not a good thing, but I had friends in recovery who took me in, and I slept. I couch surfed for a year and a half.
Wow. We're chatting with Jeff Grant.
I took care of my family.
Did you have children, Jeff?
I had two children, still do. I have two daughters who are now 33 and almost 37. But at the time I tried to kill myself, they were 18 and 14. So this is almost 20 years. This is all unfolded. And they took it hard. Yeah, they couldn't believe this was their dad, the successful guy, member of a school board, owned businesses, owned a restaurant. You know, I was a big fish in a little pond in Rye, in Mamaroneck, in New York. And this was the last thing I think that they pictured their dad doing was, you know, them sitting with me on the front steps of Silver Hill Hospital, crying, you know, is this my dad? But
how is your relationship with them now, Jeff? How's your relationship with them now?
I would say overall, it's good. I have four grandchildren. I'm in their lives. And my daughters moved on. They moved on better once I went away, frankly. I didn't realize how much of a cloud it casts over a family when dad is going through these kind of things. And it really stunted their growth in a lot of ways. And as soon as I left for prison, it was as if they had the ability to bloom and to find new lives. And not without difficulties. And their entire way of life was destroyed. And these were very privileged kids. And I didn't realize how much that life of privilege was actually handcuffing them, was not giving them tools for success later in life. You know, I lived in Greenwich and Rye for 30 years. I see it in homes every day where people give their kids everything, but what they're not giving them is the tools for success. And I was one of those guys. You know, I did everything for my kids, and now they chop their own wood. They're successful in their own right, and so I have relationships with everyone now. But it took a lot of years.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're chatting with Jeff Grant. That kind of thing can't mend itself overnight. And you can't hasten whatever kind of process they have to go through in order to be able to handle what happened to them. You can't make that go faster.
No, I don't. But what I could do, and what it took me a lot of years, was to get into acceptance about what I had done and how I had hurt them. Mm-hmm. And then start the process of making amends. But even that took a lot of years. And I would say that once we started, once I decided to go to seminary, because I got home from prison in 2007, and a couple of years later, I decided to go to seminary, and I applied to Union Theological Seminary. And I was accepted as a felon, as a white-collar criminal. And I spent 3 years learning about faith and social justice and, you know, a very rigorous program of study. It's a master's degree like any other master's degree, but of course with it's in a professional degree too, because when I came out, I was able to actually work in churches. And I had gone through some kind of conversion during that period because I was a Jew who I became baptized. And now I consider myself a double belonger. But I didn't make up that catchphrase. But I was certainly going through something, and you know, I'm not sure my Jewish kids understood it all, and I didn't understand it either. But I was looking for a way to be helpful and serve people and God in the highest, best way possible, and that was the path I took. So when I got home, I started working. I mean, when I got out of the seminary, I worked in an inner city church in Bridgeport for a couple of years and really came close to the plight of people who were going through a lot of criminal justice issues in ways that I couldn't possibly imagine. And then my then girlfriend, now my wife, Lynn, we got married in 2009. We started a ministry to support people going through white-collar justice problems and their families, which is a very misunderstood community of people. You know, we gauge everything by what we see on CNBC or we read about in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. And in truth, 99% of the people who are prosecuted for white-collar crimes are just pretty average, ordinary people who could live in Greenwich or Westport or anywhere else around the country. And, but they got in over their heads, or they had mental illness issues or drug and alcohol issues, or just kind of the pressure that they couldn't handle of living above their means, supporting a family in a world that probably honors the wrong values. Probably definitely honors the wrong values. And there they are, caught up in it, and their lives are over. At least the life they used to know is over, and I was one of them. So we founded this ministry, and we found that there was a real hole in the market. And we traveled around the country speaking at conferences and guest preaching and radio shows like yours. We've been on yours once or twice before.
Yeah,
and kind of preached how we can do better, and we can train people how to behave better. In 2016, I was on the board of Family Reentry, which is a large Connecticut criminal justice nonprofit, and they asked me to become their CEO and executive director right here in Bridgeport. Mm-hmm. And that was in reaction to what was going on in the state, which was, you know, a fiscal crisis at the time. And Family Reentry knew, they had to have known, that they were asking a guy who had been to prison for white-collar crime to become the head of their agency.
Yeah, but there's a reason for that, right? Because they figure you've got the big picture and the empathy.
Yeah, but also with some risk, because you can never tell how you're going to upset donors.
I guess so.
But yeah, it's just the way it is. And but it turns out I was the first person in the country who had been who had been incarcerated for white collar crime to be made the head of that kind of an organization. And that was a gift and, kind of a breaking of the glass ceiling for people who have criminal justice issues to rise.
We're chatting with Jeff Grant. Jeff, can you stay on? We're gonna come back. We've got some sponsors who have some messages for our audience here at WICC. 203-333-9422 is our number. If you've got a question for Jeff Grant or a comment, we're talking about coming full circle. We're going to come back and give you the latest on where Connecticut stands with respect to the Clean Slate Act. So stay tuned for more of the Lisa Wexler Show here on WICC. We'll be right back.
If you're thinking about it, she's talking about it. Join the conversation at 203-333-9422. The Lisa Wexler Show, WICC 600.
And welcome back. Rejoining us is Jeff Grant. Jeff, what's the name of your ministries? Is it the Jeff Grant Ministries? What's it called? Jeff, you there?
Oh, can you
hear
me?
Hello, hello? Now
I'm
I can.
Here, I'm
Jeff,
here, I'm
what's the name of your ministries?
It's Progressive Prison Ministries, and we're founded in Greenwich. And our website is prisonist.org. That's prisonist like feminist. Prisonist.org.
So, Jeff, just very quickly, because we are going to run out of time. First of all, I think congratulations are in order. Have you not been readmitted to the bar after all this? Tell us.
Thank you. Yeah. On May 5th, the Appellate Division of the State of New York, or the Supreme Court of the State of New York, reinstated my license to practice law. So it's huge for us. It's huge for our family. It's huge for me. And it's huge for the criminal justice community because there obviously are not enough lawyers out there who have lived experience and the empathy and the understanding who've been through it, who can represent people with criminal justice issues and do it in a dignified way, in a way that really honors the person who's going through these issues. So that was the reason.
Are you
going to
do criminal defense work now? Are you going to go back into criminal defense?
I think what I'm going to do primarily is be private general counsel to people who are going through these issues. Because the thing that we found in the ministry is that people have like all kinds of problems when they're going through criminal justice issues. They have marital issues and home issues and tax issues and business issues and partnership issues, tons and tons and tons of issues, as well as emotional and spiritual issues. And what they don't have is a good long-term plan. And so everybody, or most people, what they do is they hyper-focus on the thing that's right in front of them that's not going to prison. And that's a big one. They should be focusing on that. But almost everybody wakes up 10 years later and says, you know, if I had known then what I know now, I would have made different decisions. I would have set my priorities differently. I would have allocated my resources differently to give myself the best chance over the long haul to be successful, happy, productive. And so why not have people and professionals who from the very beginning can help you make those long-term decisions that are going to best assure your success? So it's kind of like being in a hospital. When you check into a hospital, the first person you meet is a social worker who works on your discharge plan. That's even before you meet with a doctor. So, like, why do they care about your discharge so much? And the answer is because they want you to leave the hospital in better condition than you are when you went in. And
so, Jeff,
the criminal justice system. Go ahead.
Yeah. I just want to go a little bit because we are going to run out. I just want to talk a little bit about this Clean Slate Bill in Connecticut, which Governor Lamont signed, but he said he had reservations because he felt that there were still some crimes that are going to be clean slated that he would not have included in the list. And in fact, he urged the legislature in a separate letter to take another look at this. So notwithstanding the fact that he had reservations about it, he signed it anyway. But it's being heralded as one of the most liberal, progressive criminal justice pieces of legislation in the whole country. It goes further than almost any other state in terms of giving people a clean slate. You must be pretty happy about it, I would guess.
Well, I'm certainly happy about it. Connecticut always had a pretty progressive pardons board. The problem is that a lot of people didn't take advantage of it. For many, many years, we've had the ability, not always, but for many, many years, we've had the ability to people who have misdemeanors, who had the ability to get a pardon after 3 years and a felony of a pardon after 5 years. But what the, you know, the practicality of that is that it really took many more years, and that it really takes a culture, an entire community to help people get a pardon. Now there are certain crimes, low-level felonies and a lot of misdemeanors that will automatically be expunged after, in the case of a misdemeanor, 5 years, in the case of a felony, after 10. Is it a perfect bill? No. There are others around the country who have similarly progressive bills. So Pennsylvania is one that comes to mind. And will it have to be reconsidered over the years to see whether or not it's actually working, what the recidivism rate is? Is it actually helping people reintegrate, get jobs, be more available? We'll have to
see.
Jeff
Grant, thank you for being on the show today. It's prisonist.org. If you want to find out more about it. Go ahead.
And the law firm is grantlaw.com.
Grantlaw.com. Good luck, Jeff. Good luck. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Lisa.
We'll be back for the next hour of the show coming right up.